Hey, Mitt Romney.
American Right to Life Action wants to stop the killing of unborn children.
But at first, you said that abortion should be legal. Then, eyeing the Utah governor's mansion, you wrote that you were not pro-choice.
Then, in liberal Massachusetts, you ran supporting abortion.
Now for the Republican nomination, you're against abortion again?
Mitt, you're a liar.
And the lives of these kids are at stake.
You described your turning point talk with Harvard researcher Douglas Melvin.
But you lied about that. And after you claimed a pro-life conversion,
you supported federal funding for research on embryonic humans.
You appointed pro-abortion Democrat Nestor as a district court judge.
And you said you still support killing kids in Massachusetts.
While you mislead voters,
Planned Parenthood keeps killing kids.
Mitt, you play voters for fools.
If you're not a fool,
call Romney and tell him to stop lying. Paid for by American Right to Life Action.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. On today's show, we're going to have an informal debate about strategy. But first, did you hear what happened yesterday in New Hampshire? Barack Obama held a rally in Rochester, New Hampshire, and he was shouted down by 15 pro-life activists. They chanted, "Abortion is an abomination." Abortion is an abomination. You might want to check out the video on YouTube. But now let's get to the debate at hand. On the phone from Portland, Oregon, we will have Nathan Sheets, who is a blogger. He writes with Live Journal and pro-life blogs. Nathan Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, real easy to find on the internet. And Nathan has written against American Right to Life's aggressive criticism of National Right to Life. And in studio, we will have Brian Rohrbaugh, president of American Right to Life, and author of a widely read rebuttal to an anti-personhood memo put out by National Right to Life's general counsel, James Bopp. Brian's article is titled, "The Legacy of Judas, National Right to Life." I have some quotes in front of me from Nathan Sheets and Brian Rohrbaugh's in studio. We're expecting a constructive discussion. So welcome to both of you to Bob Enyart Live. Nathan, how are you doing?
Good. How are you guys?
Doing good, Nathan. This is Brian. Thanks for joining us. And also, thanks for pointing out to us that our website did not have our complete strategy posted. Your criticism was exactly accurate on that, and we do appreciate you pointing it out. And then, of course, we got that up as quickly as we could.
Brian, for the audience's sake, Nathan, in his blog, said, "Hey, what's with this? American Right to Life's website, their strategy page is only negative. It's only criticizing National. There's nothing positive there. What are they recommending we do?" And so you guys acknowledged that and uploaded the positive strategy recommended by American Right to Life. So you're thanking Nathan for that criticism.
That's right.
All right.
You're welcome.
Nathan, the deck is stacked a little bit against Nathan. I am biased as the moderator here. I'm a talk show host, and I agree with the strategy of American Right to Life. There's a disagreement between the personhood wing of the pro-life movement and those who advocate regulating abortion as the best approach toward saving some lives now and eventually stopping child killing. So I'd like to invite both of you to make some opening comment. And then I have three questions that I'd like to ask each of you. And this is an informal discussion. So, of course, Nathan, Brian, you guys can take the lead. So, Nathan, would you like to begin?
Sure thing. First of all, I want to make it clear that I don't speak for National Right to Life. I don't work for them or anything, so I'm not really part of their organization. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things for me is that there's a lot at stake right now, and the biggest thing that's at stake is, should we choose to change the strategy at this point when it seems to me and a lot of other people that we're closer than ever to overturning Roe? If we're going to change the strategy now, will that have a good effect or a detrimental effect? And I'm all for strategy changes, and I mean, I'm not a typical pro-lifer. I think that there's a lot that we could be doing. I don't really like the whole let's change everybody's hearts first approach. I believe that we should be changing laws. And again, this whole thing started because of the lack of information on the American Right to Life website. that was just my annoyance there. So I blogged about it, and then it turned into this big whole thing. But for me, I mean, I was born in 1985. I haven't been around for the whole thing, and so it's, you know, I kind of showed up in the middle here. But it's like, what do I want to do? Do I want to support something which I feel will be detrimental, or do I want to support something which I feel will be productive in our debates?
Well, that's a great opening statement. Thank you very much, Nathan Sheets. And Brian Rohrbaugh is in studio. Brian?
Well, one of the things, Nathan, you said that you think we're close to overturning Roe versus Wade, and I think we were closer in 1973 than we are today. I don't think that anything we've done has proven to change the minds of our lawmakers to be against abortion. If anything, I think everything that we've done over all these years has actually promoted the culture of abortion. And so that's probably where our fundamental disagreement would start. I can't find any evidence that we have pro-life Supreme Court justices. I can't find evidence that we have federal judges who are pro-life, even state judges who are pro-life, with very, very few exceptions.
Okay. Thank you both for the opening comments, and I'd like to start with a couple questions. And Nathan, this is a favorite approach of mine. I like to ask people who are supporting a position, can you see any potential downsides to your position? And so the National Right to Life strategy for decades now has been regulating, the regulating of abortion. Abortion is the intentional killing of unborn children. So I refer to it as child killing regulation. So do you see any potential downside to regulating abortion?
Yeah, I see plenty of downsides to simply regulating abortion. But I don't think that's what the pro-life movement does only. I think there's a lot of aspects besides the judicial system and legislative. But some of the downsides, I think American Right to Life has several, you know, good points as far as at least questioning for the culture, do these laws, does it further put them against abortion or for abortion? Mm. I think that's a legitimate question, and I can see it. I think it just totally depends where you are, not just with the regulations and the incrementalism, but just with the pro-life movement in general, what we do. I mean, I have many frustrations, like saying child killing. I have no problem saying child killing, and yet on my blog, I get pro-lifers who are like, maybe you shouldn't use that language. It's like, well, what is this? Are we going to be, you know, against child killing or what, you know?
Right. In fact, for about 30 years, quite a few pro-life leaders in the pro-life industry, as I call it, would argue that it's not murder, that we shouldn't refer to the intentional killing of a child in the womb as murder. And right there, that helps to undermine the personhood understanding of the child, because it is murder. He's an innocent human being.
I agree with that. I think abortion is a euphemism in and of itself. It's a euphemism for dismembering or murdering or whatever. Mm. And so, yeah, I think not just from regulation, but at least from what the movement has been doing for the past, you know, 30-whatever years, there are plenty of downsides.
All right,
I think
well,
that those need a change.
All right. Well, thank you. And so I jotted down of your answer regarding the actual regulating of abortion, that American Right to Life, they make some good points, specifically what kind of effect does this have on the culture when we regulate child killing? Is it possible that that could have a negative effect on the public and on voters and so on? Brian Rohrbaugh, I'd like to ask you the same question as the president of American Right to Life. Can you present any downside to your position, which I think rightly is called an absolutist position, that you're promoting personhood and you completely oppose child killing regulations? Any downsides to that?
Well, yeah, there is downsides. And of course, what we're promoting is the God-given right to life. And it's actually a right given by God. And no government, no subdivision of government ever had the authority to take that away. But in terms of a downside of stating that and of promoting personhood, certainly it creates division among the pro-life ranks. There are people who have dedicated their life, their hearts are pure, they're trying to save children, and they've done all this work, and now they look at us and say, all you're doing is causing trouble. Nothing you're doing is helpful. A
so
downside is a division there. We would lose the support of some of the people who are so dedicated to the other strategy, and certainly the Republican Party, which by and large has been viewed for some reason or another as being a pro-life party. Now, there are many Republican legislators who are angry with us, who think we're much too strong.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's an honest answer. Do either of you have a comment to the other's answer?
I think that hearing somebody from American Right to Life at least acknowledge that there are people in the pro-life movement with good hearts, I mean, that's somewhat comforting. Generally, from the press releases or from the website, we don't really get that acknowledgement. It's almost somewhat insinuated that people at National Right to Life or people who are for incrementalism or whatever, that they're like somehow for abortion. So, I mean, it's comforting to hear that. And I'm not against being negative, and that's kind of one of the annoying things is, like, I like discussing this issue and which is the better approach or what can we do to somehow get both of them in there. And then you have people walk in and be like, oh, well, we're being negative. I mean, I understand exactly why American Right to Life is negative. They view what National is doing as a detriment. So I'm not against necessarily being negative, but it's good to at least acknowledge the other side's hearts in this issue.
Well, yes, yeah, certainly. And one of the things, and I've written about this as president of Colorado Right to Life, the most tangible thing the pro-life movement has to show its successes are the sidewalk counselors and the crisis pregnancy resource centers. Those are the two areas where we can actually prove we're saving children and where there's great work done by people who are really, really dedicated.
Well, and Nathan's point that there are people in the regulating side of the movement that their heart is that they love the Lord and they fight for the innocent. In Kansas City at National Right to Life's annual convention, we had a hospitality suite, the founders of American Right to Life, and it was 40 floors above the convention in the Hyatt. And Nathan, there were people there. Hundreds of conventioners came up and spent an hour, two, 3 hours in the hospitality suite, in the theater, and they saw the excerpts from the recent partial birth abortion ruling, excerpts stating explicitly that if you pull the baby out to the navel, you can kill that same baby. If you pull it out to the belly button, you could kill it. If it slips out inadvertently to the neck, then you could still kill it, like a standard partial birth abortion. And the justice is recommending that perhaps some alternative method could be found to terminate, to kill these late-term babies, one that looks a little better for the medical community. And so there were women who, I'm saying women, men too, but the most visibly expressive women who actually cried real tears, saying, for 15 years, I fought to outlaw partial birth abortion. I thought it was going to stop all late-term abortions. I thought it would do this. And here's Dr. James Dobson's quote saying, ending partial birth abortion does not save a single human life. And it turns out that that's true. So there are people on that side who have a real heart for doing what's right, but I think they've been led by a strategy that has been counterproductive. Now I'd like to get to my second question to you guys. I'd like to go through a list of different segments of the population, like judges, politicians, voters, pregnant moms, and ask both of you to comment on the respective strategies, personhood or regulations, and the effect they may have, for example, to start with, on judges. Let's say we go to a judge, and it's a conservative judge, and we say, we want you to sign this informed consent law. If the woman signs this piece of paper, it's criminal to have an abortion in Indiana. I have the Indiana law in front of me. It's criminal to have an abortion in Indiana, except if the woman signs this informed consent. So what kind of effect will that have on the judge who signs that law? Nathan, do you think that will have a positive effect on that judge?
I think it totally depends on the judge and where he's coming from. If he's a conservative judge and he holds any kind of pro-life value, I think he'll most likely see it as something, you know, because we're really limited as to what we can do at this point because of Roe versus Wade. And so informed consent would at least be, I mean, there are many, many issues, especially with informed consent. I think it's one of the most common sense pieces of legislation that we could have because there are so many lies that Planned Parenthood or any abortion provider, they give to women or they withhold information. So I think that for a judge, I think it would have a positive effect on the judge or a neutral effect. I mean, okay. I think it's just something that's common sense.
Can you think of any negative effect it might have on a judge for him to rule that, yes, abortion is illegal unless the woman signs this sheet of paper, and then she can kill the baby.
Well, if it's the judge that you described, I really don't see a negative effect.
All right. Brian Orba.
Well, anything where we establish in law or we tell judges that this is okay, that says as long as you follow this regulation, then it's okay if you kill the baby.
Then it's legal if you kill the baby.
Right. That's inherently evil. Anything that authorizes the murder of the innocent, regardless of how you arrive at it, whether it's by signing a consent form or getting your parents' permission, or even if you wait 24 hours, then you're justified in killing the baby.
You mean legitimate,
legally. Legitimately,
according to the
right.
law, you are now authorized by the legislators and the judge
right.
who upheld the law. And these regulation laws, I describe them as, and then you could kill the baby laws, because that's what they explicitly
that's what the meaning
authorize.
Is. Right.
And many of them state it, like this Indiana informed consent law. Abortion is illegal in Indiana, except if the mother signs her informed consent.
Right. And so what you're telling the judge is there is no command from God that says do not murder. And you're establishing that it's okay to murder. You just have to follow our legislative principles or our judicial principles. That's inherently devaluing to human life, and it harms society. Those type of regulations can only persuade people that there is no God-given right to life, and it's up to men to decide what to do and how to do it. And it undermines Christianity. It undermines all of God's commands, and it elevates man's law to being the supreme justice, which it is not.
Nathan?
The fact is that child killing is already legal. So whether or not there is an informed consent law or not, I mean, the child killing is going to happen, and informed consent will at least do something for the women who will have their minds changed actually having some information.
All
I mean,
right.
I don't know the specifics about that particular bill and how much information is actually being given.
Well, we could get to the women in a moment. For now, I'd like to focus on what does it do to the judge to ask a judge to uphold the law that says if you sign this paper, then you could kill the baby. So
well,
let's
focus on
the judge.
Okay, so what Brian said on principle, as far as, you know, the God-given right to life, I mean, I think that sounds good in principle, but I don't really think that judges generally use that as a criterion for what laws they're passing. I think they don't really look at that. I mean, maybe they should, but they're...
We would agree. I'm saying we because I'm a supporter of American right to life. Yeah, we agree. In fact, the entire U.S. Supreme Court, all the justices, including the 7 of the 9 nominated by Republican presidents, think that God's command, do not murder, is not relevant. And what is relevant is that we follow the process. And as long as you follow the process, you could legitimize the killing of the innocent. So the question to you, Nathan, is could you see that this iterative process of pro-lifers going to judges and saying, will you authorize this law that says follow this regulation and then you could kill the baby, that has a negative effect on the judges?
On the judges, again, no, I don't think so, because in principle, you're saying that the law is telling them that God approves of this or whatever, but that's not what the law is saying.
No, not that God approves of it, just that the government has the authority. Let me ask you this. Does the government have the authority to regulate the intentional killing of innocent children?
Well, the spiritual authority, no, not at all.
No.
But I mean, if within its jurisdiction, I mean, it can pass laws that are just and laws that are not just.
Oh, right. So I'm talking about in laws that are just, right? Because Germany, they had laws that said you could kill Jews, and a lot of this stuff was litigated, and they had major Supreme Court justices, if you will, giving out death sentences to Jews like Marcus Luftgas, who was guilty of hoarding eggs. And so was it just? Well, let me ask you that to test the bottom line of your worldview. Is it just for a judge to rule that you can kill a Jew if he's following the process?
No, not at all.
Not at all. So in America, is it just for an American judge to rule that you can kill a baby if he's following the process?
No, not on principle, no.
Okay, no, not at all. That's correct. It's not right. So the pro-life movement is conditioning our own judges that we nominate and get confirmed. We are conditioning our own judges to think that it is just, that it is legitimate, for them to authorize the killing of innocent children.
I would not agree with that, however, because while there's the Bible and while there's what is just and what is not just, like from what our ideal is, we still live in a pro-choice United States generally. There's a lot of misinformation. And so when I think when a judge passes that, especially if it's a conservative judge like you described,
well, say Scalia or Thomas.
I think it's more of a reaction of to do something. It's like, are we going to do nothing and you stand on our principle, or are we going to do something and save some of the children?
Well, Nathan, one of the things that I would use as evidence that we've caused harm is the first abortion laws in this country were not Roe versus Wade. They were state laws. And here in Colorado on April 25th, 1967, our Republican governor, John Love, signed in the first permissive abortion law for health of the mother and rape and incest. Now, this is really critical to think through, because for rape and incest, what he was saying is it's okay to kill the child for the crimes of his father. That's what that law did. That was in 1967. But now, almost every pro-lifer you talk to and all of the Republican legislators always want an amendment to any type of law that would end abortion that gives an exception for rape and incest. And so we have come so far that the very first laws that opened the door to this are now the standard that National Right to Life promotes. And I think that's evidence that there is great harm when you start trying to regulate and trying to reason with saying that, okay, we'll allow some in an effort to stop others. You undermine personhood with that. You're not establishing that every life is precious. You're establishing the authority of the government to allow the killing of some for whatever reason they see fit.
I don't think that the rape and incest rhetoric was started at that particular point. I think it's been a part of abortion rights language for quite a while.
Well,
and so I understand that. I understand the line of reasoning of why it would be bad to have an exception for rape and incest. But again, I don't think that Republicans generally support that because they agree with it, but because they think that there's no other way to pass a bill. So I don't think it's undermining personhood so much as it is, okay, we're going to do what we can to pass the bill.
But don't you see that the thing that opened up the door to the slaughter of all these innocent children was rape and incest? That was the standard by which abortion became legal. And now it has spread to being legal at any time through all 9 months, right up through and during delivery. It's legal to kill the child. But the door opened with this, and now people who are saying they're trying to end abortion are holding the same standard that opened the door. Don't you see that the reality is, if it opened the door in 1967, there's no way 40 years later that this logic can close the door? It's not possible.
See, I don't follow that at all, because I think that while that may have opened the door to it, I think that the reason why we hold out rape and incest exceptions is so that a bill can pass. I think there are plenty of ways that we can see that bills would not have passed. But again, the problem is that we have Roe versus Wade in effect. And even after Roe versus Wade is overturned, and even after any kind of personhood legislation would be passed at a federal level, you're still going to have an America where Americans, the very first thing they think of when they hear about abortion is rape and incest. And so that's one of the biggest problems, is how are we going to get past it? And
Nathan,
just because it may have started it, doesn't necessarily mean that we shouldn't follow the strategy now of including those exceptions in bills.
All right, Nathan, and I'm glad you're crystallizing that. You are acknowledging that the strategy that was started by the pro-abortion forces in America is the strategy now that we are following in hopes of defeating them. But when they introduced abortion for rape and incest, what that did, to accept that means that you reject the personhood of the child. Even Blackmun in Roe v. Wade wrote in that decision, and even the pro-abortion forces who testified at the Supreme Court agreed that if you could establish the personhood of the unborn, then the case for abortion collapses, because if the unborn is a person, then you can't regulate the killing of that child.
Correct.
So you could acknowledge, you just did, and I'm thankful, that arguing that you can kill the baby for the crimes of his father undermines the personhood understanding of the baby. You agree with that?
No, I don't think so at all.
Let me restate it. If you argue if you accept that you can kill the baby because his father was a rapist, and this is what the pro-abortion forces, they made this argument. You can kill the baby if his father was a rapist. Therefore, the baby is not a person. So you could really kill it at any time. That's their argument.
That's the pro-abortionist argument.
And do you agree with Blackmun in this point, that if you could prove the baby is a person, you can't kill him? Do you agree with that?
I don't practically agree with that, because I think it's quite proven that the unborn is a person.
Well, no, that's what the debate is. And even National Right to Life was against federal personhood efforts 30 years ago, and 30 years later, they're against state personhood efforts. So, and certainly the Democrats and the pro-choice and most Republican Party leaders don't agree that the unborn is a person.
Well, but are they against the personhood efforts because they don't agree that the unborn are people, or is there another reason?
Many believe that. Many believe that the unborn is not a person until it takes a breath. And so when you say, when you put in the law that you can kill a child for rape and incest, you have undermined the personhood understanding of that baby. You should be able to acknowledge that.
I don't have to acknowledge that, because I think that, first of all, I think it's ridiculous to say that just because National has undermined the personhood effort, it's because they don't agree that rape and incest babies are people. I think it has more to do with strategy.
I didn't say that, and I don't mean to say that. But they do undermine the public's understanding of personhood when they spend millions of dollars promoting a view, a law, or a politician who says if the father's a rapist, then you could kill the baby. That's educating millions of uninformed people. And some of those millions come away believing, you know what? You could kill the baby for rape. And so those people are being confused to think that the baby's not a person, it's something else, because you can kill it in the right circumstances.
I think to think that that confusion comes from National Right to Life or any pro-life laws, as opposed to the pro-abortionist strategies and the way they infiltrate the public schools and the universities, I think that that's kind of a ridiculous thing to say. I don't think that it's pro-life bills that cause people to say, oh, well, there's rape and incest. I mean, I can understand the point of view that maybe it would solidify some people's opinions of that, but I think that pro-life laws at least cause people to think, especially with a late-term abortion ban, for example, or partial birth abortion. You know, what those laws do is they make the public think. I like to work on college campuses sometime with the Center for Bioethical Reform, and one of the main things that I talk to people about is their version of pro-choice, like a normal person's version of pro-choice, is not the pro-choice movement's version of pro-choice. And so there's rape and incest, and that's always the first thing they throw out at me. And so I'm willing in a debate with a person to say, okay, fine, we'll look past the rape and incest at this point, but let's look at these other things, because what it is a roadblock. And I think that's National Right to Life's purpose. When they have a law, they're saying, you know what, we don't want people to get caught up on rape and incest, which I think in a lot of ways is what American Right to Life does. And we don't want them to get caught up on rape and incest because we want a law to pass that will at least save them babies. I mean, whether or not you agree with that, that's one thing. But, I mean, I think that's their thinking in passing the laws with those things.
Well, Nathan, have you read the Roe versus Wade decision?
Yeah.
And the footnotes in it?
Because one
of the things that Blackmun pointed out, and this was really interesting, he said that Texas couldn't have it both ways. They couldn't claim that the child had rights, but then have their own exceptions for rape and incest. That was actually a cornerstone of their justification for abortion, was that Texas was claiming what you just said. And in terms of educating people, the education is a double-edged sword. When you say that there's a partial birth abortion ban, and then someone who hasn't made up their mind looks up the ban and reads it and finds out it's only a 4-inch variation, that hasn't done anything to establish personhood or limit abortion. All that's done is say, hey, the Supreme Court said that there are many ways you can kill a late-term child and there's nothing wrong with it. So we have to be careful with that kind of logic.
Let me break into my own broadcast. Hi, this is Bob Enyart. I hope you are enjoying this program. If you are, tune in tomorrow for the conclusion right here on Bob Enyart Live. Now, if you've missed part of it, of course, you could go to our website, kgov.com, and listen to it again in its entirety from beginning to end, or send a link to a friend so they could listen to it online. Or you can subscribe to our monthly sermons. That's where you would get a CD in the mail about the middle of each month, and you'll enjoy the four sermons from the pulpit of Denver Bible Church. Of course, you can also subscribe to our monthly Bible album, where you receive an entire album of Bible study on the different books of the Bible and different topics. So all that is available at KGov online at kgov.com or by calling us at 800-8-N-YARDS. That's 800-836-9278. Thank you so much for listening. God bless you.